The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
So thank you. Thank you, Michelle, and thank you for coming. In the film The Matrix, Morpheus, who's played by Lawrence Fishburne, offers Neo, who's played by Keanu Reeves, a stark choice. He can either gain a greater understanding of the complex forces that comprise the world in which he lives, or he can continue in a state of imperiled ignorance as though they don't exist. You take the blue pill, and the story ends, promises Morpheus. This, by the way, was before Viagra. You wake in your bed and you believe whatever you want to believe. Or you take the red pill, and you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes. Now, generally speaking, America prefers the blue pill. It starts with the founding myth that the nation was discovered and founded not on genocide and slavery, but freedom and democracy. And since then, there's been the unrelenting pursuit of progress. Sure, there have been some bumps on the road, a few hundred years of slavery, decades of Jim Crow in terms of the Japanese, a little bit of McCarthyism. Some bumps were bigger than others, but America was always rumbling in the right direction. Now, when I first came to this country in 2003, I bought a school history textbook so I could know what you all know. I know England's myths. I was raised with them. I've seen the way in which England eases itself into its murky history like an old man easing itself into a cold bath, content to wallow in its own filth. But I know that power has many parents, but the brutality it takes to acquire it is always an orphan. That's why so much black history during Black History Month take place in a passive voice. Rosa Parks was kicked off the bus. People were denied service at the lunch counter. Things were done, but nobody did them. There was racism, nobody denies that, but apparently no racists. Anyway, the final chapter of the textbook that I got, called American Promise, ends with this rallying cry. The history of the United States is one of challenges faced, problems resolved, and crises overcome. Throughout their history, Americans have remained an optimistic people, carrying this optimism into the new century. The full promise of America, it says, has yet to be realized. This is the real promise of America, the ability to dream of a better world to come. Such are the assumptions beamed from the torch of Lady Liberty and coursing through the veins of the nation's political culture that are imbibed with mother's milk. The nation, many will tell you, is not just a landmass but an ideal. A shining city on the hill, beckoning a bright new tomorrow and a dazzling dawn for all those who want it badly enough. Take the blue pill, and the story of the last few years, racially, can be interpreted any range of ways. The necessary slaying of unruly street thugs by honorable police officers, a series of incidents in which young people and rattled officers have produced unfortunate but inevitable outcomes, or even outrageous examples of individual police exercising unnecessary and unlawful force on minority communities. And all these conclusions would qualify for the blue pill for the simple reason that in various ways they would understand Ferguson and those things that have come after it as one-offs. Flawed responses maybe, but isolated incidents that don't spread beyond their borders. A glitch in the matrix, but not a challenge to the matrix itself. We actually saw this with the DOJ report, the Department of Justice report into Ferguson, which laid bare the reign of terror in which black people had been living in this Midwestern suburb, which few even knew existed outside of that area. Between 2007 and 2014, one woman was arrested twice, spent 6 days in jail, and paid $550 as a result of one illegal parking ticket, for which she was originally charged $151. She tried to pay in smaller installments, $25 or $50 a time, but the court refused to accept anything less than a full payment, which she could never afford. 7 years after the original infraction, $151 ticket, by the way. She still owed $541. This was how Ferguson raised his revenue. This was not a glitch in the system. This was the system. In the same month Michael Brown was killed, police went into the house of a man and dragged him out. And he said, "You don't have a reason to lock me up." And the officer said, "Nigger, I can find something to lock you up on." "Good luck with that," the man responded, and the officer slammed his face into a wall and he fell to the floor. "Don't pass out, motherfucker, because I'm not carrying you to my car," the officer said. Ferguson was unremarkable in every way, which is precisely what makes the goings-on there noteworthy. It was happening there, if it was happening there, then it could be happening anywhere. Take a red pill and you're forced to recognize that there can be only so many isolated incidents before we must establish a pattern, and that the nature of that pattern will not be confined to that incident, but color our understanding of how society operates. "The way we see things is affected by what we know and what we believe," wrote John Berger in The Ways of Seeing. "The relation between what we see and what we know is never settled." And what's truly unsettling about these high-profile police killings is that what happened to Michael Brown doesn't contradict what takes place daily in America, but just illustrates it. What was unsettling was that those who questioned the wisdom of protesters when there was violence in Ferguson or Baltimore must at least acknowledge that they would never have heard of Michael Brown or Freddie Gray without that violence. That there would have been no federal investigation by the Attorney General without it. That if it takes a riot for America to remember the names of children killed by police officers, then that tells you more about the country than it does about the rioters. I was in Ferguson a few times, and actually along with my colleague here, Chris McGreal, and it's important to calibrate what happened there, because if you watch CNN or actually any of the TV news, you basically saw the same car burn over and over again, and the same CBS, as though CBS has rights in the Constitution, being violated, and that this was, you know, the horror of what took place. And actually it was pretty small scale stuff. In Detroit in 67, 43 people died and over 1,000 were injured. In Watts in 65, 34 people died, over 1,000 injured. Newark, 67, 26 people died, hundreds injured. This was primarily, in Ferguson, a police riot and a media circus. And the media circus provided the footage on rotation. What's really unsettling when we think about not just Michael Brown, and the problem with doing meetings like this is that you start with things like Ferguson, they ask for the title of the speech. By the time you come to give it, so many more kids have died. There have been so many more incidents that it's really very difficult to keep up. But what's interesting is that there are places in America where young people are not supposed to go. Movie theaters, schools, college campuses, and their death prompt great moral panic if little change. But then there are places where they are expected to die. The shooting of a teenager in a poor black neighborhood often earns little more than a paragraph in a local paper. Beyond their communities, their passing prompts little more than a weary and familiar sign. To exist as a working class African American is to be vulnerable. To live in a poor black area renders you collateral. So when these kids are shot, we're told to wait until the facts come out before rushing to judgment. But as James Baldwin wrote when covering a trial in 1992, to suspend judgment demands that one dismiss one's perceptions at the very moment that one is most crucially and cruelly dependent on them. So they say wait for the facts to come out, but the facts are out there. We know that a black person is killed every 28 hours in this country by the police or someone working in security. We know that black kids are 21 times more likely to be shot by police than white kids. We know that police stopped and frisked more than 4 million people in New York in a decade, most of them black and Latino, and according to their own figures, 90% of them are innocent. We know that at current rates, one in every 3 black boys born in 2001 will go to jail. We know that black youth do not use drugs at a greater rate than white youth, but are far more likely to be incarcerated for drug crimes. We know that black life expectancy in Washington, D.C., black male life expectancy, in Washington, D.C. is lower than male life expectancy on the Gaza Strip. We know that black infant mortality in this city, Chicago, is on a par with infant mortality on the West Bank. We know that black preschoolers, that's four-year-olds, are four times more likely to be suspended than white preschoolers. We know that the former New York Police Commissioner, Ray Kelly, told a state senator that he targeted black and Latino youth because he wanted to instill fear in them that every time they left their homes, they could be targeted by police. We know that there are more African-American men in prison or on probation or on parole in the US now than there were enslaved in 1850. We know that because felons lose the right to vote, there were more African-American men disenfranchised in 2004 than in 1870, the year male franchise was secured. We know that there are more people in the US penal system than were imprisoned in the Soviet Gulag at its height. You already know enough, wrote Sven Lindqvist in Exterminate All the Brutes, and so do I. It's not knowledge we lack. What is missing is the courage to understand what we know and draw conclusions. And so it's not difficult to come to the conclusion that when we see what happened to Michael Brown, and Eric Garner, and Tamar Rice, and Wondered Myers, and Kajimi Powell, and Oscar Grant, and Freddie Gray, and Trayvon Martin, and on, that these are not statistical aberrations, but systemic abominations. A system cannot fail those it was never meant to protect, wrote Du Bois. This is not a glitch in the matrix. This is the way the matrix was designed. So the grand jury deliberations into Michael Brown and Eric Garner's murders, for example, were never just about the fate of a few police officers and a couple of dead black people. It was about the value of black life. It passed judgment on whether there was a price to pay for summarily removing people from the planet, or whether it's just a cost of doing business, when one man has a badge and a gun, and the other has too much melanin. Under slavery, an owner would have to be reimbursed for a slave who was deemed unreasonably slaughtered. Under Jim Crow, they would leave lynched bodies hanging to warn others of the price of transgression, real or imagined. When Michael Brown's body, was left lying lifeless for 4 hours before the police collected it, it was an ugly metaphor for the contempt of black life in this post-civil rights, post-industrial moment. Dispensable, despised, and discarded. Just take a moment to think about what that hashtag, Black Lives Matter, really means. Because you wouldn't have a hashtag that said, black men can play basketball, or black music matters, because only the most deluded and stupid would ever challenge that. The reason Black Lives Matter has resonated so widely is because it succinctly surmises where we are. You can celebrate a black president, black professors, black astrophysicists, black tennis players, all we want. But the issue of the sanctity of black life has still not been settled. Because the red pill is a very bitter pill to swallow, and the rabbit hole is deep and dark. I'm writing, or just finished writing a book at the moment about all of the children and teens who were shot dead in one day in America. Every day, 7 kids are shot dead in America, on average. And I chose a day at random, and I've been reporting on talking to the families and reporting on the cases. 10 kids died on the day that I picked, which was the weekend before Thanksgiving in 2013. And of those 10, 7 were black. They're just the ones I know about. I'm sure there were more of them. And every single black parent, when you ask them, did you think this could happen to your child? Was this something that you were braced for? They all said, of course, yeah, of course, of course. And, you know, what one father in Europe, one mom in Dallas said, well, I didn't think it would be him, I thought it would be a girl. The father in Europe just said, you're not doing your job as a father if you don't think that your son could be shot dead. And this is the angst. This is what to me amounts to a state of terror. You don't actually have to have your child be shot. You have to live with the concern that your child might be shot. So everybody's got that concern, and then one or two or three people, depending on the day, are picked up. That these uprisings should come in the midst of a slew of 50th anniversaries from the Civil Rights Movement. Mississippi Freedom Summer, Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act, March on Washington, is sobering, particularly for those who still believe that this is a land of unrelenting progress. Because from the endless platitudes that we have come so far but still have so far to go, we must now check in the historical baggage that is making that journey so tardy. The discrepancy between black and white employment is the same as it was 50 years ago. The discrepancy between black and white wealth is greater. The discrepancy between black and white incarceration is greater. Black children across the South now attend majority black schools at levels not seen in four decades. Now that's not to say that we've literally reverted to a bygone era. No person ever steps in the same river twice, goes a proverb, for it's not the same river and it's not the same person. There is a black president, a black attorney general, a black editor of the New York Times. There's more interracial relationships in diverse suburbs. If the civil rights movement had been about getting black faces in high places, its work would now be done. But it wasn't. It was about equality. And the problem is not that we still have a great deal of progress to be made or that progress is too slow, it's that we're actually regressing. And there is no place in the American myth for regression. Hence the title, A Nation of Laws and a History of Injustice. For on the night of the grand jury verdict, which decided that Darren Wilson did not even have a case to answer, Obama did what presidents do in moments of strife. He came on television and declared, we are a nation based on the rule of law. So we need to accept that this was the special jury's decision to make. Now, this is no doubt true, but without further clarification and qualification, it's also meaningless. The trouble is that for far longer than America has been a nation of laws, it has been a nation of injustice. And in the absence of basic justice, such laws can amount to little more than codified tyranny. It was no less a nation of laws when they jailed children as young as six in Birmingham, Alabama, or massacred Native Americans and stole their land. The question is whom these laws are supposed to serve and protect, by what end and to what means. The law, wrote James Baldwin, is meant to be my servant and not my master, still less my torturer and my murderer. And so the call for law at certain points in times of revolt and order has no meaning without an assessment of the order that prevailed before the rioting started. Those who call for law and order must now understand that there is no order because men with badges have been acting lawlessly. What peace can there be when an 18-year-old can be shot dead while walking down the street with his hands up in a surrender position? What order are we to observe when a man selling cigarettes on the street can be strangled to death in broad daylight? The truth is that almost all the significant gains that black people have made in this country towards full citizenship have not come by observing the law, but by breaking it. And it's through this chasm between the official claim to an impartial legal system and the legacy of endemic racial justice that so many of these police, like Darren Wilson, make their escape with the flames of the ghetto in hot pursuit. When so few policemen are indicted, let alone convicted of killing black people, they comprise not a special category, but a protected and an elevated one. In this nation of laws, those charged with enforcing the law evidently operate above it, while the judiciary exists not to mediate between the police and the public, but to defend the police from the public. Once again, this is not a bump in the road. This is the road. So this is not a morality play in which decent black people are slain by malicious white cops. The inherent nature of the injustice was not systematic, but systemic. Darren Wilson did not wake up and think, I need to kill myself a black boy today. It's just that when the black boy showed up, he felt that there was going to be no price to pay for removing him from the planet. If we were to believe the Department of Justice report into Ferguson, the entire system was corrupt. Almost everybody resigned. And somehow, Darren Wilson was the sole person who was left unscathed by all of this corruption. And this is why the efforts to either defile the assailants or defend the characters of the dead are so wrong-headed. The right concentrate on character defamation. Michael Brown was a thug, they say. He allegedly stole cigarillos. He deserved to die. Tamar Rice shouldn't have been playing with a gun in the park. Where were his parents? And black people are bought into this too. A Brown's eulogy, Al Sharpton, emphasized blackness has never been about gangster, being a gangster or a thug. Blackness was, no matter how low we were pushed down, we rose up anyhow. But here's the thing. Thugs have rights too. Thugs are human beings too. tantalise man. And in this nation of laws, the penalty for stealing cigarillos is not summary execution. And those who don't understand that, but who claim to be on the side of justice, will be forever trying to justify why someone was not worthy of a bullet, rather than protecting any person's right to walk the streets in safety. Now, with this isolated episode, we could talk in terms of individuals. We're not. It's a structural. So the personalities are best, at best, secondary irrelevant at all. Because you can't fight white supremacy by behaving better. We know from movements past that it was when they filled the jails and took to the streets that things started moving. These young kids could pull up their pants as high as we like, but they would still never be able to outrun a policeman's bullet.
Yeah.
Similarly, Darren Wilson does not need to be evil. He just needs to operate in an institution where the chance that you'll be sanctioned for killing a black youth is minimal. And in an organization where in a culture where armed white men cite their fear of unarmed black men as a defense. A fear so intense that they have to shoot them. Have to. Since apparently no other possible outcome is possible. Such fears do not come from nowhere. To assume that when you see a black man, you see a criminal, is rooted in the fact that black men have been systemically criminalized. So what next? What next? What we've seen so far in response to these killings has been very popular mediated interventions and eruptions that have significantly gained global attention. But popularity isn't the same as efficacy. It's found an audience but has yet to develop a program. And this is in no small part as much about the moment as it is about the movement. In the post-civil rights era, racism, much like neoliberal globalization, has become a force without a face. Black people can be whatever they want to be individually, so long as they don't want to be equal as a group. We can have a black president so long as he doesn't stand too openly and too closely alongside black people. We can revel in him singing Amazing Grace in a church so long as he's ditched his radical black preacher and is singing at a black funeral. This is why comparisons between this moment and the civil rights era fall short. Back then there were clear targets. When they marched over Edmund Peters Bridge in 65 in Selma, they were marching for the vote. When they took on the Freedom Rides in 61, they were trying to integrate interstate travel. When they marched in Birmingham in 63, they were opposing segregation. But today the signs are down and the abstract rights exist. The physical barriers are gone. And yet inequality has not arrived. Racism is utterly embedded in our institutions, from the courthouse to the schoolhouse. That to pick one part is to make the whole thing unravel. So literally, where do we march? To the jail, to the police station, to the courts, to the governor's mansions? And when we get there, what do we demand? An end to racism? What would that even look like? Police cameras? How much good did that do, Eric Garner? This should come as no surprise, these conundrums, this challenge. 50 years ago, Bayard Rustin, the architect of the March on Washington, saw this coming. In an essay called From Protest to Power, in commentary in 1965, he wrote, "The very decade which has witnessed the decline of legal Jim Crow has also seen the rise of de facto segregation in our most fundamental institutions. More Negroes are unemployed today than in 54, that was the year the Brown versus Board of Education was passed, and the unemployment gap between the races is widened. Legal niceties aside, a resident of a racial ghetto lives in segregated housing, and more Negroes fall into this category than ever before. As a consequence of this natural evolution, the Negro today finds himself stymied by obstacles of a far greater magnitude than the legal barriers he was attacking before. Automation, urban decay, de facto school segregation. These are problems which, while conditioned by Jim Crow, do not vanish upon its demise. They are more deeply rooted in our socioeconomic order. They are the result of the total society's failure to meet not only the Negro's needs, but human needs generally." I think another way of putting that is, what does it mean to gain equality in a country which thrives on the notion of inequality? So you have your civil rights, but the country actually thrives on the notion of a general inequality. These are problems to which I think we don't have answers. And what's encouraging is that at least we're starting to ask the right questions. At least we're mobilized, even if we don't exactly know where we're going. The blue pill is a sedative. It puts you to sleep, believing a cure is around the corner, only to wake up and find that nothing has changed. The red pill offers some clarity, but no cure. It shows you how deep the rabbit hole goes, but it cannot show you how to get out.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.